matters of the Exodus and the leaving of Egypt, going toward the wilderness, and puts in some dating material, various other things like that. Not romantic dating, you understand, but what dates these things took place. But it also has some matters on the book of Exodus. We'll look through some of the outline of that. Before you can really get into the wilderness wandering, you have to get out of Egypt and some of those things that are dealt with there, because they're dealt with over and over again as you come into the wilderness wandering. And so we want to look at that. Anybody else need material? Okay. I think we're doing good there. I'm going to ask Matt Allen to lead us in a word of prayer in just a moment. Some of you are on Facebook and following social media. You know I posted about Jonathan Carino, man that... Right. When we start looking at this, I thought we needed to start by talking about the purpose for our study. Why select the wilderness wanderings? How many of you have had a class on the wilderness wandering by itself? Not too many do that, and I haven't taught it but one other time that I can think of. And so the idea of why to do that, these things are written for our learning. If somebody will turn to Romans chapter 15 and verse 4, please. Romans 15, verse 4. Go ahead. Okay. As Paul's writing this to those at Rome, what is he talking about, those things written before? All right, the Old Testament is what he's talking about. And his point is that these things are written for our learning. We're supposed to learn something. I've had people sometimes tell me, well, we're not under the Old Covenant, so why would we study the Old Testament? We're under the New Testament. Let's just throw away our Old Testament studies and study the New Testament. What's the problem with that? Okay, it's all Scripture. It's the foundation that's there. Let me ask you something. When you start out teaching your children about the nature of the need for obedience, how many of you turned back to an Old Testament story to teach them that? How many other principles did you teach by going back to an Old Testament story? I remember we had the old Hurlbut's stories that were there, Bible stories that Mom would read to us, and I learned a lot of principles there. Why do you need to know those principles that are found in the Old Testament? What learning that Paul talks about, what do we learn from them? All right. All right. You talk about the subject that you want to discuss. And I suggest to you, you can't possibly talk about that without going back to the Old Testament at some point. How do you deal with creation, with the existence of this world, without going back to Genesis 1 and 2? How do you deal with marriage without going back to Genesis 2 and see the law that Jesus points out? Have you not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female, and so forth? He went back there to those things of the Old Testament. Those kind of principles are ones that we recognize when we start out in the Old Testament. We see the principles that lead us to see how it is a schoolmaster or a tutor to bring us to Christ, so that we can understand bit by bit these principles that will come to establish the full. Go ahead. All right. When you look at the points made in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, let me ask you to turn over there with me if you will. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 11, we'll start out. It says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate of the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters as some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come." Now what's the statement that's made about that? That these things happened to them for what? For examples. What are all of those things listed there in in 1 Corinthians 10, 1 through 11? Where did they all come from? From the Old Testament, and specifically the wilderness wandering, the going out of Egypt, being baptized in the sea, as he talked about, and in the cloud. And that point is made. So he talks to those who are in New Testament times. And by the way, in Corinth, did you have a great number of Jewish people? I mean, was that a Jewish center? No, basically it was what kind of a church? Gentiles. And yet he's referring to the Old Testament and calling their mind to that. They were to understand these things. They were to study these principles that they hadn't grown up on, many of them, as Gentiles. And they take place with regard to the Exodus and wilderness wanderings. That's the specific cited for that. Now, someone read verse 12 for me. What is it supposed to tell us? Verse 12. Okay. When you see a therefore, what do you ask? What's that therefore? Therefore. There you go. Now, what is the purpose of it? He's drawing a conclusion based on the first 11 verses, right? And what's that conclusion? What are we supposed to do when we look at those Old Testament stories? Okay. All right. We see where they fail, and specifically, what does that call us to do? Take heed, lest what? Lest we fall. So that apostasy that could take place there is something that specifically is pointed out and based on the wilderness wanderings. Now, let's go over to Hebrews chapters 3 and 4 and notice some things. Again, you have here specifically cited the statements that take place are coming along and telling us what happened in the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings, specifically the wanderings here more especially. He uses Psalm 95 to remind us of the events. So let's just turn to Hebrews 3 and read those, someone, verses 7 through 11, please. Okay, here's this point that's made. He quotes Psalm 95. What are the events again? Those of the wilderness, right? What was the problem that they experienced in the wilderness? All right, rebellion. They had been ones that had gone astray, he says, in their heart. They had not known the way of God. They had been ones that had tested him. Each of us, as we go through, we're going to notice specific cases. That's not saying once or twice Israel did that. during this period. This is something that's going to be repeated. It's something we're going to see over and over and over again. Now, did they rebel in the exact same way we do today? Okay. Have you rebelled when God said you speak to the rock rather than you strike the rock in order to get water? You hadn't done that. Have you spoken against the Lord that he hadn't fed you any manna today? Or maybe you were tired of eating manna for several months and said, I need some flesh. We need to have some quail. No, we don't have the exact same points, but in principle, do we do the same thing? Now, here's the point that I want us to think about. How many times do we do the same thing in principle, but on far less of a reason than Israel did? How would you like to eat manna in the wilderness for 40 years? And I mean going month after month after month with manna. Do you think you would really be happy with that and say, I'm not going to want anything else? Well, I'm not happy if I don't have a pizza every week. You know, this diet that has you no pizza, that's criminal, I guarantee. There are different things like that, and we see these points where we sometimes are unsatisfied and we grumble about that kind of a thing. So once we start talking about, well, Israel did this, that, and the other, take a look back in the mirror and say, hey, what am I doing about this? Because in principle, I think what we're going to see in the wilderness wanderings is we see ourselves. And it helps us to recognize where our own problems are and the need to stay away from some of those things. The next thing that you have is in verses 12 of Hebrews 3, on down through chapter 4 and verse 11, and that's an extended point that tells how it was that God was displeased with them. Look there in chapter 3, and then just notice in verse 12 through the end of the chapter, beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief and departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. While it is said, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who, having heard, rebelled? Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt led by Moses? Now, with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. What is the word unbelief paralleled with there several times? Disobedience. Unbelief and disobedience, the Hebrew writer is dealing with it, are one and the same. Why? Why does someone disobey? Okay. They say, I don't think that's necessary. Well, what's the problem? Problem my own thinking, my lack of belief in what God said as being that which is essential. And so you have this. You repeatedly find in the wilderness wandering, Israel trying to substitute their plan for God's plan. They didn't like how God did it. They didn't like why God did it. They didn't like when God did it. And therefore, they were going to want to do it their own way. In some of those times, they wanted to come around and do the thing that God had commanded. They just didn't want to do it when he said. Or they didn't want to do it the way he said. And we're going to see how God viewed that. All of these things, what I'm trying to suggest is, they show a pattern. And when we look at them, we see a pattern of disobedience, the kind of things that God is not happy with, the kind of things that are displeasing to him. And the wilderness wanderings is where you go over and over again in the New Testament to learn that point. That's what he said. When you take people who came out of the land of Egypt. Let me ask you something again. Here you go through the sea. You're seeing water on either side. How much confidence do you have in the power of God at that time? When you get on the other side, there you are, you've been led through, water's brought in on the Egyptian. How much kind of a confidence do you have in your salvation? But what did he say about that? We're ones who have that salvation in the end if we hold fast the beginning of our confidence, what? Verse 14. Till the end. How long did they need to continue to have confidence in God's salvation from that point to the point of entering into the land? All the way through to the end. What was their problem? They didn't. They had it for a little while. They let it slip away. How about us? Do we ever have those times where we let our confidence and our faith slip? And sometimes we go back into things of wrong. And what we need to do is have that same kind of a point. This is a great lesson when you look at this. And over again, the New Testament deals with this particular point. So you give repeated warnings about the events of wilderness wandering. That's why we need to take a close look at this. And a lot of times that isn't done. We're going to try to do it. We're going to do it in an overview fashion. We're not going to go just through verse by verse through Numbers and Deuteronomy. Some parts of it we will, but most of it we're going to take an overview, and you're going to be needing to look at that and read through, and I'm going to ask some questions, some of which are in your material and some of which aren't, and we'll try to talk about the things that go on there. Let's talk about the start in the events in Egypt. Most people have a understanding of where Egypt was. Ancient Egypt, of course, is one that existed along the Nile. The Nile was the source of all life, source of activity for them. It had to do with their sustenance. That's how they got their crops, was by the flooding of the Nile, the bringing out of that silt, the fertilization of the land, and then the coming back in, the canals that went to water things. Outside of that narrow strip of the Nile, you don't have a lot of life present. You didn't have it then. You don't have it really very much today either, if you will. When we talk about ancient Egypt, it's extending a little farther south than what we would talk about with modern Egypt. Modern Egypt would be a little bit more confined north of there. But this is going to go a little bit farther down the south. This is where you find ancient Egypt coming down even to the idea of what's called Namibia, and most of the time Nubia, as it was called in ancient periods, was that which was under the dominance or under the control of the Egyptian Empire, and it was a place where they would get much of their work done with regard to not only plants and everything, but also with regard to quarrying rock and some other things. When you look at that land of Egypt, you notice in green this area along the Nile. And then you have some oasis areas that are out here away from that. And that's basically where the empire existed. With all of this, you had various kind of army encampments that were there. We're going to come up when we talk about the going out of Egypt. There were three different roads that you could have taken to go out of Egypt in the direction that was generally towards the east. All of them were ones that were to some extent fortified, but the northernmost one, which was the direct route to go into the land, was the most fortified. Obvious reason why. Because that's where most of their agriculture was. That's where most of their product was. And so this is where you'd have the heaviest concentration of their military power. When you look at Egypt along the Nile, here's the whoops. That's not what I wanted to do. Here's the Nile in that picture. You see the green right there? How green does that look? How well are you going to be able to grow a crop there? That's modern Egypt. It's still like that. You see a very clear, distinct line from where you have fertilized agricultural territory and where you have just flat desert. It's quickly something that ends. When you talk about in the book of Exodus, especially going out of Egypt, this is what they're talking about. Going from a fertilized area into that which is not. That which would sustain life, Egypt. That which wouldn't, that's desert. That's called out of Egypt. And so when you're looking at it, what happened? We're going to notice when you go through the wilderness wandering taking place, you have them leaving a very fertile area, and where they cross, you have immediately getting into a deserted area that's very clearly deserted. We're going to talk about four different theories on the crossing and where it may have been. I think there's a pretty clear case for that. It's not something that's all that difficult to me to figure out, and most of the scholars in that, whether they're liberal or conservative, are pretty much in agreement as far as what they've found on where these cities are that are named in numbers and so forth. It's going to be pretty easy to figure that out. There's a lot known about ancient Egypt. The hieroglyphics. I took Middle Egyptian hieroglyphics when I was in graduate work. That and about $1.50 will get me a cheap cup of coffee, you know, in some places. And it was an easy language. It was just real simple. It's one of the most simple things I've ever heard. About 6 weeks and you got it. It's not a difficult thing at all. But think back in a time when you didn't have any way for that to be broken. What you had was a language that was there, that it was obvious it was a language of some kind. A lot of writing that was there. In some cases, you've got symbols. In some cases, you've got what appear to be some kind of letters. But in other cases, you've got what seem to be letters, but they're also pictures. And so it's very difficult to know what's a letter and what is a determinative, as they suggest. The word determinative simply means it's a picture of what the thing's about. For instance, you have in Egyptian a word for donkey. It's spelled out, and at the end of that, whether they're writing this way or that way, and it goes both ways in Egypt. I don't know exactly why. But at the end of it, you had a donkey. Well, if you didn't know that's what the word donkey was, you'd figure it out by the donkey, wouldn't you? So there were some of the things that were easy, but what made it something that ultimately was broken and deciphered was the Rosetta Stone that was discovered in the late 1792, I believe it was. It's in your material. And it had the Middle Egyptian hieroglyphics, another language that was there that was known, and then Greek. So you had something that was very easily then put together. You knew that they were all saying the same thing because the stone divided it in three parts, and it was very obvious. The parts of the other languages were saying the same thing. So now it was just a matter of cracking the code. What does Egyptian say? And they were able to do that. When they were, then they were led to a bunch of sources that were there to chronicle their rulers. On your lesson sheets, in that first lesson by Brother Mark Gibson on page 2, if you'll notice, it has these Egyptian sources. The Palermo Stone, the Royal List at Karnak, and it goes on down there and lists 6 of those. The last one being a royal canon that was in the library at Turin, Italy. All of those help them to see who it was that were rulers. And they have a very good kind of an agreement among themselves so that there is a very clear check to see what are these rulers and how long did they rule and so forth. All of that's there. Then, if you'll notice in that next section, he talks about some things that I'm not going to get into, the Sothic cycle that's there of the calendar and how you had that determined. It isn't in the same kind of a years that we would have, so they kind of had to crack that too and go through all of those things. Ultimately, what happens is you've got a very clear way of being able to date things that take place in Egypt and be very sure about the dates all the way through the Middle Kingdom back, not much beyond that. That's real clear. There's also a fellow by the name of Manetho. And Manetho was one who was a writer in Egypt, probably a priest of one of their temples. And he was an advisor to the Ptolemaic rulers. And so he wrote a great deal about the culture of Egypt, about the leaders of Egypt. At the time that Josephus, especially, and also Eusebius, one of those who was a patristic writer, at the time they lived, they obviously had the full text of Manetho. We don't have that. It doesn't survive. But they quoted it extensively. And so you have a lot of things with regard to the day-to-day life, with regard to their religious activity, with regard to their gods and what they thought these gods did, various rulers, rituals that were there, calendar days that would be the various holidays, a lot of those kind of things. So we know a whole lot about Egypt, as much as any of the ancient realms, for sure. What we've gotten out of that is basically this chart that's given there just, I think, on the next page, if you look. Yes, on the third page of that lesson one. The early dynastic period, you go all the way to 3150 B.C. Remember, B.C., before Christ, we're counting backwards. In other words, the older is those that are more, and then you're coming down, lesser gets more recent. When you get to about the Middle Kingdom, right in there, that's where we're pretty comfortable with those dates. We have enough information and enough pretty clear kind of things on going back and looking at events that take place in the constellations and so forth the way they do by just going back. We can be pretty sure of those dates. Certainly with any of them, within a few couple of years at the very most of the time within a month or two. So from there on, you've got a pretty good picture of what's taking place. Now, why is that important? What do you notice about those dates? That's about when you have firm dates going, you have the time of Abraham and forward from there. And so we can be pretty sure of what's taking place in Egypt. And what you see is when you go through those chronologies, there has never been a single case where there is a discrepancy, where there's something that's a conflict between those calendars and what we know from biblical events. Now, you're going to find people that are going to say that's false, and those in the liberal scholarly realms, they're going to say, well, no, that's not what happened. We don't think this happened there, but they don't have a fact that would be in discrepancy. The facts are all out there. It's a question of how do you interpret those facts. And there is no fact that is in conflict with anything the Bible says, with any evidence of what you have in the material that we know of that is in Egypt. Now, when you look at the establishing of the Old Testament chronology, let's go back and talk about something. The key date that we can come along with, it's dated the fourth year of Solomon's reign, is stated to be the 480th year after the Exodus. That's what we're told in Scripture in 1 Kings 6. So when we know that's the time period that we're talking about, how much confidence can we have about when we can go back and date the Exodus? If we can date it, then we can either go backwards from where Solomon was, or we can go forwards from where the Exodus was and date Solomon. We can check that, right? And we have a pretty good idea when Solomon's beginning time was and when the fourth year would be, and all of that fits. Now, when you look at that, you also notice, putting those passages together, the date of the Exodus. If this was 480 years afterward, then what do? We add 480 to that. And what do we come up with? 1446. Right? So that's how we get the date there. Both of those work well. Now, I might point out to you that if you talk to those who are in liberal circles, liberal theologians, they're not going to like that date at all. They're going to usually go for the time of the Exodus as being under Ramses II. I think you'll notice that over in the third lesson, first page, that he talks about some of those things. That they try to make it under Ramses, that won't work. I remember having heard that several times from preachers while I've grown up, is that Ramses was the one who was the Pharaoh when they came out of Egypt. No less than Charlton Heston said it in Moses, you know, in the movie there. You've got all these things, but it doesn't work. That puts it probably about 250 years later than what you have to have it by the biblical time. But that statement there, that it is 480 years, when you look in Hebrew, at times they'll take a part and they will make it a whole. In other words, if it was 478 years, sometimes they would round that off and say 480. Now, if you give that enough to play with there, of that 2 years, which I think is fair, 2 or 3 years, then you're dealing with the error factor you also know in the Egyptian chronologies, and everything fits together. Well, if that's the time of the Exodus, about 1446, then Moses was 80 years old at the time of the Exodus, so what do we know? We know Moses' birth. And since we know his death, that he lived 120 years, then we take that and we subtract 120 from there, and there we've got the time of his death that's dealt with in Deuteronomy 34. You go back from there, they were in Egypt 430 years, according to Exodus chapter 12. And so what do? You go and you put that time that Jacob entered in, from being the time when you have that entering, or that time of them going away from the Exodus, 430 years plus tells you when Jacob entered and when they go down into Egypt. Then you have Jacob's birth, because he was one who lived 130 years old. He was 130 years old when he came into Egypt, so we know when he was born. Isaac was 60 years old when Jacob was born, so we know Isaac's birth that time. And then you've got Abraham's birth, because Abraham was one who was 100 years old when Isaac was born. You see the points of what we're doing? We're taking chronology based on what the Scripture says, and we're putting this together. If this is right, and I think one of the key points, you can establish the Exodus date pretty clearly, not only from a good statement of what we know about Abraham's time, and about certainly the time of King David, King Solomon, as to those dates, but also from some of this extra-biblical material that you have, especially from Egypt. Anybody got anything there? All right. Let me suggest something to you. When you put all this together, then what's going to happen? We're going to look at this a little bit next time, more of these events. But what your material does is it spends some time going through Egyptian history, dating that in years B.C., and then dating these events from the biblical record, because the two fit. And when you look at it and you see who the rulers were, and you see what was done, it makes it just real clear, it all fits. One of the things that's amazing to me is that you look at this and you have the children of Israel going down into Egypt. They're ones that are accepted there. They're put into a place. They're mighty. The land was filled with them. They're fruitful. They're abundant. But then the next thing you find out is, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. How could that happen? I mean, a king that doesn't know Joseph, and yet you have this lineage of kings that are there. They're all related. The problem is you have the Hyksos rulers. Whoop. The Hyksos rulers that come in at that point. And the Hyksos rulers are coming out from the desert areas. They're real nomadic people. They're more Semitic in their nature. And so they're the ones who come in and they take over rule. That fits because now you have these people who didn't know them. They started an oppression. Whenever you've got good slaves, do you want to give them up? No. So what happens is when you have the new kingdom come along, you have the restoration of the native Egyptian rule, but they continued to oppress. And that's where you notice, and we're going to talk about in some detail, these guys who are involved in that time of the biblical story of when you have them going into Egypt and then coming out of Egypt. These are the ones that are there. Now, we know those guys. They're well known. They're not ones that we have to wonder about. That chart isn't displaying right. That title should be all on one deal. So I think this is going to be a problem. If you've got a squeamish stomach, you might not want to look at these. But you've got almost the first. There's his mummy. We don't have any doubt about it. It was seen in the Valley of the Kings and the tombs that were there, and it's labeled. There's no doubt whatsoever. He's the guy. There's the statue of him. Then you have this guy, Amenhotep I. That's his mummy. We got that one too. No doubt about the fact that it was him. And there's the statue. He's the original Conehead. And then you've got Thutmose the First, that's his mummy. And there you've got a statue of his labeled as to who he was. These are successors. They're all listed in the Chronicles. They're also listed repeatedly in ruins that you have that you've got attributed to them. There's the next one. There's his mummy. We know he existed. Got it labeled, no doubt about it. He was a real person. There's the kind of Sphinx statue that's there of him. Then you had a usurping queen that was there who came along. We've also got drawings of hers. There's a real reason we don't have the mummy, and that is that she was a woman. She usurped the throne. She wouldn't be allowed to have her sarcophagus and mummified remains in the king. She made herself to be for a while, but she wasn't going to be honored in that sort of way. Then you've got Thutmose III. He's going to be the one that you would have during the time of Moses' life where he's over in Midian. He dies. There's his mummy. We know he was a real guy. There's a picture of a statue that was there to him. And then we have this guy, Amenhotep II, and there's his statue. Interesting. He was the one that would have been the pharaoh, if this is correct, and I think it is. He would have been the pharaoh that would have been there during the time of the Exodus, that would have been involved in losing the battle and his armies being destroyed. He's the only one of those pharaohs during that time that we don't have his mummy. Now, I'm not saying that proves anything. I'm just saying there's no conflict with what the Bible says there, with him being one who his army loses, and likely he's the one that himself, not just an emissary that's there. Sometimes an emissary is spoken of as the Pharaoh. I'll grant that. But you don't have him there. His army lost. It could be that he was one who his body wasn't one of those that washed up. I don't know. But that's what you find. Okay, we're going to stop there. I'm supposed to stop quickly, so we'll take up that point next week.